So our text today is the eighth of the Ten Commandments. So it's Exodus 20, verse 15, another exceedingly short text. You shall not steal. The word of God for the people of God. And now the story. True story this time. I remember when I was 14 or 15, I was skiing at Sugarloaf, and when I went back out after lunch, someone had taken my poles. You're supposed to gasp. You know, because honestly, in that moment, I felt very deeply, I mean, it's kind of a word that sounds silly, except it really captures the feeling, violated. And I was so mad that it seemed the most natural, it seemed totally justifiable to grab somebody else's poles. In the way that our minds work, especially at 14, the person who had taken my poles was faceless, and so was the person whose poles I took, right? So it's just kind of like, without even thinking, you just kind of conflate the two, right? Someone had lashed out at me out of the dark, so I just lashed back out into the dark. And of course, once I cooled down a little bit, because I am a thinking person, right? I couldn't help but imagine the next person coming along after me, right? The person whose poles I had taken and being absolutely just as outraged and just as violated and feeling exactly what I had felt. And that, of course, then the guilt settles in that I had that inarticulate sense, right? That if I could see that faceless person who had taken my poles, I would see my own face. And I was ashamed. And I had to relive that every time I went skiing for years. Because every time I reached for those poles, it's like, yeah, I remember that. And I suspect that the person whose poles I took responded more maturely than the 14-year-old me. But it's really not too hard to imagine, right? It's just kind of a little thought exercise, that they might react the same way and take someone else's poles, who then felt justified in taking the next person's poles, right? And then so on down the line until everyone on the mountain that day both had their poles stolen and in turn stole someone else's. So that everyone on the mountain that day went home feeling both angry at being victimized and guilty for being a thief. And that little thought experiment starts to feel like a pretty good picture of the world. Everyone outraged at how they are treated, and therefore feeling justified at treating others the same way, so that the whole world is both victim and villain, angry, outraged, and really guilty and ashamed. And that at this point in Exodus, into that sort of a world, right, God shows up on a flaming mountain and speaks to us in the Ten Commandments. To a world that is feeling both the deep violation of being victimized and the condemnation of really knowing we are guilty, he says, you shall not steal. And because of the shame that we all carry deep in our psyche since the day that Adam, like, suddenly blushed and grabbed the nearest fig leaf, we almost always see the fire on the mountain as a threat of violence. And we hear the word as a stern, even angry command. Don't you ever do that again, or you will know why. right? And hearing it that way, our self-condemnation, right, cries out, oh, I'll never, never do it again, right? And we, in that moment, we sincerely think, no, I will never do that again. And we try to make ourselves feel as bad as possible, and hopefully there will be some kind of fence next time around. But just as the leopard cannot change its spots, no matter how big we beat our, how big that pack of guilt we load on ourselves, no matter how many times we swear up and down, we are powerless to change ourselves. And we only set ourselves up for greater failure and greater disillusionment. And hopefully, kind of thinking through some of these commands in the series, we're learning that the love and the forgiveness and the acceptance that historically we see in God's deliverance of Israel from Egypt to bring them to Sinai, and then also the love, forgiveness, and acceptance that we see even more clearly in Jesus Christ changes that image of the fire on the mountain and the voice that speaks the commands. Right? Hopefully we're seeing that the love, forgiveness, and acceptance that God has shown us throughout history means that the fire on the mountain is simply the glory and the passion of a God whom the world itself cannot contain. And that the word, you shall not steal, is a promise of what God intends to do with us if we are willing to follow him as his people out of the way that we naturally do things. I got hit, so I'm going to hit someone, into his will for us, right? By the light of the fire on the mountain, we are enabled to see a future world where people do not steal. Not where you don't do it because you're too afraid of God sending you to hell forever. I'm not saying that that's not true, right? But it's not the Christian view of what it is that we're called to and how we respond to God, how God speaks to us and how we respond to him. We're offered this vision of a world where people don't do that, where people don't steal. You will not steal. Just as you won't cheat or lie or murder. And seeing that vision of a different world, our souls, which are exhausted both with playing the victim and with all the guilt, sigh or even groan with longing and saying, Lord, is that possible? Because I've tried and I don't get anywhere. If you can do that, do that with me. And then Jesus takes us by the hand. And he says, all things are possible to those who believe. Come with me. And we follow him. And then the actual outworking of how these commands play out in our lives, yes, we participate with that, but really what we're focused on is just putting our hand in Jesus's and just walking as closely with we as we can with him, as he brings about that world where we will not steal. To be honest, I struggled the last 2 weeks with what to say about this command. Right? What are the things you normally do in a sermon? Well, there's no need to explain it, right? I mean, it's really clear what it's talking about here, right? There's no need to defend it or to like justify what it is that God cares about here, right? Because unlike some of the commands, everyone, everywhere, always says that stealing is wrong, right? One common approach in books and in sermons with some of these commands, and this one in particular, is to just to like go back through everyone's lives with a finer and finer tooth comb, right? Maybe I can't get you on tax evasion, so I'm going to think about when you went to the penny candy store when you were 7 years old. And, well, I can't get some of you on that one, so what about when you were 4 and you took a paperclip from your dad's desk without asking, right? We're going to get you somewhere, right? And you just go down. But then eventually you get to the level of just the silly, right? Yes, some of us excuse things that need to be included here. So, I mean, there does need to be some work of kind of expanding what theft means. But like I just said, that approach of progressively identifying ever more and more trivial things as transgressions sometimes really just gets into silly extremes that don't help people, right? So the question that I've been asking myself is, what needs to be said about this command that will actually help the specific people here at NWMC to follow Jesus? Honestly, I don't know. I don't think stealing or theft is the biggest problem for many of you, right? Maybe I just don't know you well enough, right? Invitation to come talk with your pastor, right? Right? Let me know what really goes on in your mind, in your life, and the next sermon on Do Not Steal might be better. So, some thoughts. Moral philosophers have often struggled, as obvious as theft being wrong is, philosophers have often struggled to find a basis for the concept of personal property. What is it that makes this sweater mine and not yours? Right? Like I said, it seems really kind of obvious, except that when you try to do the work of actually rooting it in something, it actually gets really pretty sticky. Usually, it ends up being tied to the concept of labor, right? Kind of classic example, you find a piece of wood beside the road, right? It isn't yours, it isn't anyone's. But you pick it up, you bring it home, and you spend a month in your basement carving this gorgeous whale that's like breaching out of the waves and like doing a backflip while reading a copy of Plato's The Republic, right? It's stunning, right? Now it is yours in a very, very different way, right? Because of the investment of your labor, you develop exclusive rights over it. Okay, so that's usually how the reasoning goes. And that seems to provide a basis or explain something that we all instinctively sense to be true. But actually, when you try to apply that kind of idea to more complex situations, it actually doesn't hold up as well as you might think. And really actually starts to fall apart. Like I said, the whole idea of personal property is actually not an easy thing to explain kind of the real basis of it. Except for the Christian, right? For us, it's actually very, very simple. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And therefore, all things are God's, right? He is the only one or thing that is not created, right? The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, right? The fullness thereof means and everything in it. Everything other than God belongs to God. Every last little thing is the personal property of God himself, and he gets to dispose of it as he sees fit. Then, John the Baptist, talking about something else, expresses a universal truth that plays in here. He says, a man can only receive what is given him from heaven. A person can only have, can only hold what is given him. All things belong to God, but God then gives them as he sees fit into the keeping of whomever he sees fit. Gives, not in the sense of transferring ownership from himself, it used to be God's, now it's mine, but gives in the sense of entrusts, entrusting his property into our keeping. The Christian view of personal property is that we don't have any. Nothing belongs to us. Everything belongs to God, but what I have has been entrusted to me for my good and God's glory by the real owner, who is God. As Job confesses, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. So the idea we see in these verses, and really in the whole biblical viewpoint, is that all things are God's, and he entrusts them to us as he sees fit in his kindness to us. He sees us hungry and says, here, eat my bread. He sees us cold and he says, here, live in my house. He sees us empty and he says, here, enjoy my world. Climb my mountains, tend my flowers, raise my children. Be my sons and daughters such that everything that is mine is yours. That which is in our hands is in our hands because God has put it in our hands, motivated by his love and in pursuit of our good. So far, so good. Right? But there are two corollaries to that statement. The statement that that which is in our hands is in our hands because God put it in our hands in his love and in his wisdom. Right? The first is that what is not in our hands is not in our hands because God did not put it in our hands in his love and his wisdom. That right there, for real Christian conviction, should eliminate any possibility of discontent. Obviously, the reality can be more complicated. But that is the truth behind all of our feelings and all of our experiences. What is not in our hands is not in our hands because God did not put it there. And he did not put it there in his love and in his wisdom. He did not give us what we do not have, motivated by his love and in pursuit of our good. This applies both to things that we had that have been taken from us and to things that we think we should have, things that we think should have been given to us that for some reason have not. If we accept the biblical view of things, any feeling of having been cheated by the world around us has to be abandoned. Either God is in charge or he is not. Because whatever people are doing around us, whatever people are doing to us, stealing our polls, whatever they do in their sin and brokenness, God is still above it. And he is still allowing it as he pursues a greater goal, again, in his love and in his wisdom. When faced with suffering or with injustice, that is really hard to swallow because it's not what we were made for. But God's sovereignty over the sin of the world is the basis of God's peace. When we talk about the fact that even when people do things in their sin, when we talk about having to recognize that God is still in control over human injustice, a lot of people have a really hard time accepting that. Non-Christians, but Christians too. And will push back on it really, really, more than hard. We'll push back on it with outrage because it sounds like this pietistic, just sit back and let evil run rampant and it doesn't really matter, right? It looks like we're not taking into account the reality of the way that people suffer injustice. Okay? And so many people refuse to accept the idea that God is allowing the injustice they experience. But if they're Christians, at the same time that they reject that, they still somehow hope and expect to experience the peace of God reigning in their hearts. That's wanting apples without an apple tree. Contentment with godliness is great gain, is one side of a truth, the other side of which is those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. Now, this doesn't mean that there isn't genuine injustice in the world, and it doesn't mean that we don't work against injustice. It doesn't mean that we don't speak up and take steps to right wrongs against others and even against ourselves. But when those efforts fall short, when we are victimized or denied what we believe is rightfully ours, either because someone comes along and just takes it, or because we're operating in a system that is fundamentally unjust, we will find no lasting peace other than to fall back ultimately on the bedrock that God is in control and that all things in the end either come from or do not come from Him, who is acting in love and wisdom. And that has to be relearned periodically. You really get it through your head. You really find peace. And then a couple of years later, you're back at square one, and you have to relearn it. And you grow up, and your context changes, and then because of that, your expectation changes, and you relearn this over and over and over again. And as often as we bump up against it, there is only one place to finally dig down and get your feet planted, and it is God gives, God does not give. I have exactly what God intends me to have today, and He does it in His love and in His wisdom. What God has not put in our hands, He has not put in our hands in His love and in His wisdom. But the second corollary is of that which is in my hands because God put it in my hands, right? The second corollary is then that also means what is in someone else's hands is in someone else's hands because God put it there in His love and in His wisdom. This is why theft at all levels, the really kind of the big stuff and even the more trivial stuff, is not just nature. It's not just the way the world works. Like when the alpha dog comes away and takes a bone away from another dog, right? We might look at that and see that as unjust, but it's because we're seeing something play out that reminds us of something in our own world. When dogs do that, it's not an injustice. It's just nature. And theft is not like that. It is actually sin, meaning a rebellion against God and a usurpation of His rights. And the difference between even our trivial theft being sin, a rebellion against God and usurpation of His rights, and just dogs taking bones from each other, the difference is that we are enabled to recognize that what is in someone else's hands is in their hands because God put it in their hands. What God has put in another's hands for whatever reason of His own is not my place to take from him or her. I might find it radically unjust that some people have so much while others have so little. I might find it radically unjust that jobs that are not different in any way pay $50,000 to one person and $250,000 to another. We're so accustomed to that that they're like, you guys don't even notice that. You're like, well, yeah. That's not right. It shouldn't be that way. We live in a fundamentally unjust world. And I can work against the injustice in that world. But the moment that I use that injustice to justify my taking what God has not given me, whatever that action might look like, then I have put myself into the role of God, asserting my authority to reassign according to my wisdom what he has already assigned in his wisdom. One last thought. With this command, more than any of the others, I think we are tempted to think in terms of what is legal rather than what is right or ethical. We live in a legal society. Everything is defined and regulated in statute. And it affects our thinking. We find ourselves in situations, and the basic question that we try to address is, what is allowed? What is legal? How far can I go before I cross the line? Too often we allow ourselves to get away with questionable things because we can argue that it is legal. And I want to say, especially we do this in our professional lives. Most of us work in professions where there is some sort of legal, professional code of ethics. As a Christian, that should not be your guideline. It should be part of it, right? I'm not saying that you throw it out the window, but there are much bigger questions. The question is not whether it is legal or whether it is covered by whatever code of ethics our professional organization publishes. For us, the question must always be, is this in line with God's will for me and for the world? There are all kinds of situations in business, all kinds of situations in banking, with loans, student loans, with tax filing, with wages and benefits paid, with questions of piracy and plagiarism and so on. We could just keep going on. Where our first question is, what are the accepted legal norms? What are the wages and benefits that a parallel organization is paying? Without actually stopping and looking at, is this actually just? How it's done across the industry is not our measure of right and wrong. And ultimately, when we try to look at the world through a moral lens, what is done across the industry norms is indefensible. And this again reminds us that with all of the commands, when God shows up and speaks these commands, it's not like we're standing in the clear and then looking at, okay, how do I avoid breaking the commands? Right? It's not even that the command comes to us and we recognize like these one or two incidents where we've broken it and we say, oh, forgive me, and we step back across the line and stop. Right? These commands come to us telling us not to do things in which we are already deeply enmeshed. We are deeply enmeshed in a whole system of being that is built on taking what you can get without a thought of another's interest. We have a whole moral philosophy built on that idea. And a lot of you sitting in this room, actually, that's your position, and you may not even realize it. Ayn Rand? The whole philosophy, and I'm not saying, you know, people legitimately can hold, it's called egoism, by the way, not egotism, egoism, but it is the belief that the only person who is in a suitable position to defend their rights is that person, and so that you have a moral obligation not to defend another's rights, because the way to make society work is for everyone to look after their own interests. Defending their interests is supposed to be their job. They can do it. I serve the greater good by taking care of number one. And into that mess of a world, God says, when I have my way, there will be no stealing. Everyone will be secure in what I choose to give them. And the intended response is, that is beautiful. Lead me there. Help us to follow. Amen.